Chapter 3. Essential Operating Principles. Politics is war without bloodshed, while war is politics with bloodshed. Mao. To understand our political situation, we must look at the principles under which these systems were developed and now operate. At the deepest level, they are based on war, as it is an extension of politics, and politics is a struggle for power, a form of civil war, but minus the blood, as Mao noted. These points can be argued over endlessly, but I think that they are good enough for the task at hand. Understanding our past, our development, and how these are portrayed is vital before progressing further, so I will start with our weaknesses. Back in the 1970s, for the first time, field researchers saw chimpanzees purposefully kill each other, something that was only reluctantly accepted by some biologists, even as the evidence piled up. Not only were such killings happening within groups, it was soon discovered that bands were patrolling their tribal boundaries to seek out and kill lone apes from adjoining territories. Over time, one band could be wiped out and the aggressors would take over their patch. Here, we can see how the emotions of scientists, supposedly objective followers of the facts, overcame their logic as they struggled with discarding an old assumption. Wrangham, Richard, Patterson, Dale, 1996, p. 176. Never forget that homespun maxim. Don't assume. It makes an ass out of you and me. We still see this reflected in science today, with claims that matters which governments wish to push are settled science, just as they were before the killer chimps showed us otherwise. How readily Popper's claim that falsifiability applies to all theories is forgotten when it is inconvenient, with some among our current crop of professors apparently being a cut above the old boy, no doubt so righteous as to be unaffected by funding, status, and group think. There you go, three again. You can also read a lot about this type of thing in Stuart Ritchie's appropriately titled Science Fictions, Exposing Fraud, Bias, Negligence, and Hype in Science, Ritchie 2020, a revelation of the common falsification of results by academics and scientists in pursuit of funding and fame. Ritchie notes that concern over experimental results reported in scientific journals led to attempts to replicate many of them, and the findings were woeful. Overall, the replication crisis seems, with a snap of its fingers, to have wiped half of all psychology research off the map. Ritchie, 2020, PR 31. Never forget, the experts and technocrats can be the ones being misled, misleading themselves, or conforming to career-required compliance. They are also the ones advising the UN, the World Health Organization, WHO, the WEF, and USE. Only very recently, many of these same scientific types admitted that depression is not due to a chemical imbalance in the brain after decades of issuing expensive medicines to counter it. As the lawyers say, cui bono, who benefits? Ritchie reports again on medical trials and obvious conflicts of interest. You might wonder how doctors and their patients are supposed to trust a medical literature that's permeated with bias in this way, outside of a minority of clear, well-replicated findings. My response is that I have no idea. In the US, where numbers are easily available, just over a third of registered medical trials in recent years were funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Ritchie, 2020, Peter 112. I will later demonstrate that the chance of experts getting things right in fields outside their own areas of expertise has been demonstrated to be even lower than a group of people picked at random off the street. What's more, they can be worse than those of a bunch of chimps randomly pulling levers. And this test was at a WEF conference, no less, so maybe you see now why I am happy to live by the referendum results that a nation's people offer up, rather than allowing closed-minded careerists to make important decisions on our behalf. In war, Your decisions and the principles on which you base them are tested to a bloody conclusion, not unlike on those chimp border patrols. So they must be robust and practical, but open to interpretation and nuance. As war varies so widely in scale, intensity, and resources, the principles are not expected to be mathematically precise, but are a handy, ready reckoner. As General Edmund Allenby of Jerusalem fame noted, the principles of war are eternal, but there are no rigid rules for their application. Gardner, 1965. They can be used successfully in an inspired manner by an amateur genius such as Cromwell, or disastrously in a professional way by credentialed West Pointers commanding a $1 trillion military machine in Afghanistan, losing to poor but committed hillmen armed with AKs and RPGs. However, in war, in politics, and in most spheres besides, the military's master principle of strategy can still guide us. Yet ponder it deeply, as all else will flow from it, particularly the result. First, let's see what the journalist and the Bolshevik Civil War military leader Trotsky might have made of the West's efforts against the Afghan country boys. By tactics in politics, we understand, using the analogy of military science, the art of conducting isolated operations. By strategy, we understand the art of conquest, that is, the seizure of power. Rees, 2010, Pisa 7. Who's now in power in Kabul? The master principle simply states that all considerations of policy, strategy, and tactics are subordinated to selection and maintenance of the aim. In just 6 words, the essence of most projects in life is captured, and this simple axiom originated in the system developed by 19th century Prussians. Fighting a war on terror is not what a true Western professional should select as an aim, something more precisely worded and honestly addressing the Sharia-inspired motives of their Afghan opponents should have been chosen, and the result would have been different. How exactly, I cannot say, but with a more pertinent and focused aim, the outcome would naturally be affected. Until that is done, that war on something or other just goes on and on and on. The aim of the political class was to avoid pointing the finger at the source of the problem, and that is the reason that the Americans lost the longest war they have fought in, and why we will not end the conflict with our religiously inspired opponents until we do. This master principle was taught to us on our first day at Sandhurst, and the principle is central to military thinking, and I have used it unsparingly in all spheres ever since. My life plan fitted into it neatly, was strengthened by it, and has proven its worth, especially when I failed to use it and paid the price for doing so. This volume is based on the master principle, with the goal of ensuring that the people's veto becomes a central plank of hybrid democracies around the world. As we used to do in the army when issuing orders to our troops, I will repeat that aim so that the absolute basics of what we are setting out to achieve are very clear indeed. Our aim is to ensure that the people's veto becomes a central plank of hybrid democracies around the world. I will say this for the military. They taught us by using evidence, by study of the past, and by lessons learned in war and in peace. Other fields of interest were touched upon where they were thought to have a bearing, and at the tactical level, the instructors used their experience to illustrate their points. They were generally chosen for their ability to pass these on to us in an interesting way and to stretch students, readying them to perform in combat and chaos. What has surprised me in recent years has been finding that the medical field in the UK only began formally teaching evidence-based medicine in the 1980s and 90s. More on this in Chapter 15, Evidence-Based Medicine. Even worse, to this day, some education systems are not using scientific evidence-based methods founded on cognitive research to maximize their students' ability to learn. Unbelievable but true, as I will demonstrate in Chapter 10, keep them ignorant. This book is an evidence-based tract that promotes the best form of democracy on the planet, which can readily be adopted by all representative democracies. But will they? If your representative refuses, at least you will have their measure and can use this manual to peacefully demand and win it for yourself. I wish you well. Back to the past and what we can learn from it. Low-level warfare appears to mimic the way of the chimpanzees, with tribesmen setting out from their camps and searching for vulnerable targets from adjoining tribes. It is a skulking way of war, seeking out exposed and weaker targets to ambush, preferably at dawn, to overwhelm and kill with little risk to the fighting patrol. Hunter-gatherers have been seen to routinely use these same tactics on continents around the globe. This low-level form of conflict doesn't usually end with many casualties, but with the isolated target dispatched, the killers can race for home. However, these little raids are routine affairs, and the casualties soon mount up, significantly affecting the survival chances of smaller groups. As we saw with the chimpanzees, the same goes for many outnumbered tribes. Eventual extermination and takeover of the territory, maybe with the incorporation of some female and child survivors. It is only with the growth of populations and organization that our warfare has developed more sophisticated tactics and lethal weapons, with politics and our state system growing in complexity along with these changes. Over thousands of years, various principles came to buttress the gangsterish ambush and SCARPA system, with the most effective in terms of conventional war being those developed by the Prussians in the 19th century. These have been adopted in some form by many militaries around the world. However, the hit-and-run system still has its merits, certainly as a starting point for armed conflict for weak guerrilla and insurgent forces looking to psychologically undermine an arrogant but hidebound opponent who hasn't got the will to win over the long term. Oh yes, we just covered that a little earlier. This skulking way of war has been adopted and adapted by the left, with the theme captured in Trotsky's Permanent Revolution, or today's Perpetual Resetting. The left has skulked along the most prestigious corridors of the academy and taken them over, forming minds and voting choices, just as Lenin's Comintern, Communist International, Antonio Gramsci, the Frankfurt School intellectuals, and the New Left planned. The latter loved Mao, but after their failed violent revolt in the 1960s and 70s, they scuttled off to school and began their grooming. Today, their success is reflected in U.S. Supreme Court leaks, probably by an ideologically motivated clerk, Gregorian, 2022, and law school professors who have lost faith in the system because the Supreme Court is not aligned with their views, Stern, 2022. The rot is deep, and the pressure on freedom reflects their totalitarian bent. If the people who set this train in gear loved Mao in the 1960s, where do you think they're going to take the US in the future? Underground, 1974. Conventional war strategy developed most swiftly in the 19th century as modern methods of gathering intelligence grew alongside the Prussian system. Once you could see over the hill using balloons and aircraft or tap into telephone and radio communications, the intelligence specialists became more useful to the commanders, affecting plans and developing a more professional and capable general staff. These largely replaced the personal liaison officers that generals had relied upon before. The intelligence department set up in the British Army in 1873 would go on to form the basis of our general staff, an innovation fought by many of the ever-present, no matter what the field, old-timers. It was in this period of change that the Swiss began their experiment with hybrid democracy. In 1848, the year of revolutions across Europe, they adopted referendums as a requirement for any changes to their new constitution, but elsewhere, the system gained little attention, let alone traction. This is no surprise, after all. Who would expect the political class to draw attention to, and thus drive up the demand for, a hybrid democracy that will undermine their status, their earnings, and their unrepresentative influence over policy? You might as well ask a drunk to hand over his half-empty bottle. I will not go into detail about each of the remaining 9 strategic principles, but I will list those that we were taught in training. There's no security issue here, as you can find something like them listed on the UK MODI's website or with a simple request on your search engine. This volume contains nothing classified, and I have also avoided operational details of my military past. What must be understood about the lesser principles is that they are all subordinate to the master principle, though they all need consideration. Here they are in a loose order of priority: maintenance of morale, offensive action, maintaining the initiative, surprise, concentration of force, economy of effort, flexibility, coordination, security, administration. These can all be adapted and given different emphases depending on circumstances. They are also very useful when considering issues in politics, business, and other fields. For example, swapping sales and marketing for offensive action, or increasing production efficiencies and effectiveness for economy of effort. If you put a mind map together with each of these principles in its own bubble, you could quickly knock together a plan for a business expansion campaign. I routinely used mind maps commercially, with the aim first and then bubbles for sales. Nothing doing without them. Personnel, operations, infrastructure, buildings, equipment, communications, administration, finance, legal, and any specific category required for the task. I will leave you to think over how they can be adapted to your purpose, but they certainly work and can be incorporated into many scenarios. I will, however, close on this important matter by drawing attention to the most significant of the principles that generally supports the achievement of our aim maintenance of morale. Motivated groups, all other things being equal, will generally prevail over those that are not so inspired. This is why professionals will usually defeat conscripts, but if the political will is not there, not committed jihadis. In addition, attackers need a lot more people to overcome defenders, as they are usually highly motivated, fighting for their families and their homes. War mostly favors the defenders, and in politics, this rule holds true as well. The elected incumbents and the system they are part of have some advantages over innovators looking to introduce changes, such as the people's veto and hybrid democracy. Up till now, representative democracy has successfully seen off the superior hybrid system because representatives are battling for their very existence and have kept the hybrid as hidden as is humanly possible. However, there has been democracies are cratering as a result of the inherent weakness of the system, its openness to corruption. This has led to a fatal loss of credibility as the behavior of the political class and the activities of their master manipulators have been all too evident. This obviously undermines support from the voters, who are now more likely to welcome a voter-friendly but improved alternative to replace the one gamed by the failed incumbents. Not only that, only the people's veto and the hybrid system can save our corrupted democracies in the ongoing confrontations with wannabe global authoritarians and dictatorial regimes. With the final say on our laws, the people can gain control and demonstrate a cohesiveness that has been lost, enabling us to deter all comers and setting an example for all nations and peoples seeking the same freedoms and peace that the hybrid democracy brings with it. Our recent acceptance of CCP-style restrictions indicates to the power elite that they can control us in the same fashion in the future. So now is the time we must strike, defending with our lives the freedoms that were so hard earned for us by our courageous predecessors. Intelligence was not listed among the principles taught at the academy, which miffed me a little, as it was obvious that this played a vital role in warfare. It was covered, but to my mind it was underplayed, despite it being a central feature of the military actions underway in Northern Ireland at the time. This showed me that the army was still a little slow in accepting change, still minimizing aspects of conflict coming to the fore that were displacing old ways, old regiments, and undermining the status quo. This problem with institutional change is also reflected in the political sphere and the lack of hybrid systems around the world. In this case, the political class and their masters fight its adoption by ignoring it and reducing its public profile, as they know it will be the end of their monopoly on power, especially the monopoly on issuing notes to print money that the naive voters will pay taxes on, but not the tax-exempt foundation con artists. Alongside the development of the new sophisticated strategies of the Prussians, leading figures in the commercial world began to learn from them and to develop global ambitions, reinforcing the monopolistic avarice which comes with such thinking. Bankers, commercial magnates, and political figures had always formed close relationships, from the time of the Medicis through to the Rothschilds, J.P. Morgan, Cecil Rhodes, and the Rockefellers. But the scramble for Africa, the Asian colonies, and market expansion in the Victorian age supercharged these relationships. The opportunities for secret deals, corruption, and collusion were almost unlimited, and the conscienceless among the elite took full advantage. They could develop global objectives and provide the means to implement them, often out of the public eye. Thus, plutocrats came to control the political parties that supposedly were there to serve the masses of recently enfranchised voters. Alongside these developments, revolutionary counterforces grew, most significantly in the Russian Empire, eventually gifting us with Lenin and the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, the hybrid success trod its lonely path, down the middle between the greedy know-all-right and the rabid utopian know-better left. I will cover these developments in greater depth in later chapters.